Disc 4.
By the time Chacon and company got a fix on where the Mongols were staying in Phoenix, we had ridden to a Hells Angels watering hole to make a Mongol statement. It didn't result in any violence, just some tense barroom staring between us and several Arizona-based angels. But by 2 in the morning, when headed back to the Quality Inn, the Mongols fully expected retaliation for the incident and were on high alert. A well-armed Mongol contingent was assigned to stand guard all night outside the motel. Around 3 in the morning, Chacon, Carr, and Kaz drove up to the Quality Inn and saw a parking lot full of Mongol bikes. Although they noticed several black-clad figures in the parking lot and ordinarily would have steered clear, they needed to know if my bike was among them. The welfare of their brother agent outweighed the risk of a Mongol confrontation. The 3 backup agents unsnapped their holsters and started to cruise through the parking lot. As they eased forward, scanning the rows of Harley-Davidsons, Chacon spotted my bike. This was precisely the same time that the Mongols spotted them. The outlaws quickly closed in. Dirty Ernie was the first to step in front of Chacon's headlights. He had one hand behind his back, no doubt gripping a gun. 2 other Mongols blocked their retreat. Rancid approached one side of the car, and 2 other Mongols approached the opposite side. All 3 Mongols held their gun hand behind their back. Carr, Kaz, and Chacon readied themselves. They knew the Mongols had them cornered. Each side pretended to hide the fact that they'd gone to ready-to-shoot mode, nervous palms tight around the grips and fingers on the triggers. It was a standoff. In Vietnam, the worst-case scenario for a small operational unit was to get 360'd. That's where Carr, Kaz, and Chacon found themselves. Dirty Ernie circled the car, stuck his head in through the window, and glared at the agents.
"That you, Johnny?"
he said. The 3 ATF agents weren't fooled by Dirty Ernie's ruse, though his random choice of first names was ironic. The verbal jockeying went back and forth until both sides were satisfied that a shootout might not be the most prudent course of action. The Mongols let the 3 agents drive on. Later on, we were all going to party in Scottsdale at the residence of the president of the new Arizona chapter. As I left the Quality Inn, I caught a glimpse of a sight for sore eyes, another prospect. Domingo pointed him out to me. "That's AK," he said, as in AK-47. "A new prospect from the East LA chapter." More than 100 strong, we Mongols made our way through the streets of Phoenix until we came to a surprisingly upscale community. We parked our bikes in the driveway, in the yard, and up and down the street. Then everyone adjourned to the backyard for the festivities. I hadn't even gotten my kickstand down when I heard, "Prospect!" As if just the word wasn't bad enough, I realized the call was coming from Red Dog. Then he got right in my face. "I better see you running your ass off all day, Prospect. You got that?" What I wanted to say was, "You've got the right to remain silent, you piece of shit. You got that?" But I replied with the required deference. "Sure, what do you need, Red Dog?"
"You know what I fucking need, Prospect."
I fetched Red Dog a Budweiser and continued doing my Prospect duties for another hour, until Domingo told me to take a break and fix myself a plate. As I moved to a picnic table, I got my first glimpse of the stuff from which an ATF agent's dreams are made. A group of Mongols were sitting in a semicircle, admiring an opened lockbox and briefcase. Both were full of firearms, including a MAC-10 submachine gun. I'd been sitting there for only a minute, trying as inconspicuously as possible to eavesdrop, when I heard Red Dog yelling at me again.
"What the fuck you sitting down for, Prospect? You better move your ass!"
I got back to my feet. Seeing those guns, the reason I was putting up with this abuse, fueled my resolve. How can I get word to Chacon? Jamming a group of Mongols with a cache of high-powered guns, including a MAC-10 submachine gun, would be a home run for our side. Red Dog walked up and punched me hard in the chest. "Go out front and see if the guys standing guard need anything." In silence and a bit out of breath, I turned and walked away. I was, however, keeping score, confident that Red Dog would get his due in a court of law one day. I ran hard for the rest of the day, but as I answered one Mongol call after another, in my mind, I was already starting to list and describe the makes of those guns for my 3270 ROIs, report of incident, paperwork, that would certainly counter any move by the SAC and ASAC to shut the investigation down. Around 6 in the evening, the party began to break up. Mongols began to head out, 10 or 20 to a pack. I wanted to be in the first group that left, but I soon found myself flat on my back, tools in hand, fixing Rocky's bike. His headlight was out, and it would be dark soon. We caught a break when Domingo said that we would all be riding back with the Mother Chapter. Since the Mother Chapter had its shit infinitely more together than the SFV Chapter, this was welcome news. We could see black thunderheads building on the horizon. The rain began to pelt down hard on us, beating a frenzied drumbeat on my helmet. But riding in the heavy rain, though dangerous, was a hell of a lot better than hanging around and taking a Mongol prospect beating from Red Dog. A dozen Mongols, including a guy named Mansion Mike, waited out the rain in Phoenix and left after dark. Somewhere in the desert between Phoenix and the California line, a truck driver came up too fast behind a pack of Mongols, plowing his 18-wheeler straight into the pack of Harleys. Mansion Mike was pulling up the rear and didn't even see the truck coming. The 18-wheeler smashed into his bike, dragging him and his Harley down the highway. Sometime before the truck was able to stop, Mike had lost one of his legs. The Mongols' follow truck, driven by AK and Cowboy, and filled with the stash of illegal guns I'd observed at the campsite, stopped and pulled Mike from the wreck. After the paramedics had stabilized Mike at the scene, Cowboy and AK threw his bloody clothes, which the paramedics had been forced to cut off his body, in the back of the truck and headed for the hospital along with 10 or 12 other Mongols. Later, assured that Mike would live, AK and Cowboy took the truck with the guns and continued toward L.A. It was early in the morning when they reached West Covina, east of L.A. Cowboy pulled over to take a leak. They weren't parked for more than a minute when a West Covina patrol car pulled up. Two outlaw bikers driving a beat-up pickup truck warranted a closer look. The first thing the cops saw was a blood-soaked shirt in the back of the truck. The explanation about Mansion Mike's tragic accident didn't make any difference. The cops treated the truck like a crime scene. It wasn't a good night for the Mongols. Mansion Mike lost his leg, and the cops nabbed AK and Cowboy along with that lockbox full of high-powered guns, including the MAC-10. Unfortunately, the DA's office had a big problem with the search. The Mongols retained some pretty sharp defense attorneys for Cowboy and AK, and they managed to get the seizure thrown out of court as an illegal search. Behind the scenes, Chacon went to talk to the DA as well as the West Covina Police Department, and, without divulging my role as a deep cover agent, told them that ATF had a strong interest in making this case stick. The DA dropped the state charges against Cowboy and AK, so that we had a green light to charge them in a federal prosecution. The problem, from our point of view, was that we couldn't make the local cop's gun seizure any more admissible in a federal court, not without me getting some incriminating statements on tape. It took me a few months to find the appropriate way to approach Cowboy and AK. I didn't see them on a regular basis in the San Fernando Valley, and there was no plausible way to seek them out and try to get them to make blatant criminal admissions while I was wearing a wire. This is part of the improvisational nature of undercover work. You can strategize all you want with your case agent, but sometimes you just have to have a gut feeling for when the time is right to make a move. In this case, I waited a few months until the greater Mongol nation was making a run to Palm Springs. By this point, I had become comfortable enough in the gang to carry a concealed recording device. if I thought I'd have a chance to gather pertinent information. I was still extremely anxious about carrying a wire, but at least I had access to the best digital technology the federal government had to offer in the late 1990s. When I began my career, undercover agents used to have to tape clunky old Magra recorders and microphones to their groins and their shaved chests. I could never have risked doing that with the Mongols, as we were often together for days at a time, camping out and sleeping in tight quarters. With the Mongols, I would carry a tiny, sophisticated NT microcassette recording device that I could easily hide in my coat pocket or inside my motorcycle boot. The NT made a crystal clear recording, but it had a somewhat complicated activation procedure. Another device I used was a standard Motorola pager that had been fitted with a digital recorder, which I could wear in plain view. It functioned as a working pager. The Mongols believed that I had to wear a beeper for my avionics job, and had a capability of recording up to 6 hours on a computer chip. We were all relaxing at a big outdoor party in Palm Springs. The music was loud and the beer was flowing freely. When I saw my opening, as nonchalantly as possible, I sat down with Cowboy and a few other Mongols. We bullshitted for a while, and then I leaned over and asked Cowboy how in hell he had beaten that machine gun rap in West Covina. Without any hesitation, Cowboy said the search was bad because the cops couldn't put the box of guns to anyone. He added that the cops were idiots, and if they would have searched him better, they would have found the key for the lockbox in the little front pocket of his Levi's. After they had transported him to the police jail, when the cops weren't looking, he'd pulled the key from his pants and swallowed it. I was carrying my tiny, hidden NT digital recorder during this Palm Springs party, and Cowboy's incriminating conversation was on tape. In spite of the blaring rock music, the conversation was clear and irrefutable. It was just what the U.S. Attorney's Office was hoping for. Coupled with my eyewitness testimony, we were confident of sending Cowboy and AK away to federal prison on illegal firearms charges. It also helped Chacon and me placate the brass in ATF. Getting proof of this kind of gun violation satisfied the bosses that when we eventually broke through to daylight, if I could make it to daylight, we'd be bringing down a massive racketeering case against one of the most dangerous outlaw motorcycle gangs in the country. Even among outlaw clubs, the Mongols were known as a gun-crazy bunch. Before you could become a full patch, they wanted proof that you owned at least one firearm and that you knew how to use it. Part of the application process stipulated that you had qualified with firearms under the supervision of the National Sergeant at Arms. Domingo had called me and told me to pick him up that afternoon and bring my handgun with me. Chacon and I assumed they were going to take me to a legitimate firing range somewhere north of L.A. My undercover car was a dull red, oxidized, four-speed Mustang convertible. It was fast as hell, had a half dozen bullet holes in the hood and doors from a previous ATF investigation, the chassis perforated by semi-automatic gunfire in the gang heartland of South Central L.A. Like war wounds, these pockmarks lent real credibility to my supposed badass background. The Mustang was also wired for audio, with a secret little switch I could activate under my seat. I would end up with some very incriminating conversations taped in the car before the end of this case. It was before 11 a.m. when I eased my Mustang off the Ventura Freeway and made my way to Chacon's house. The more I talked to myself about what the day might bring, the more nervous I became. I was trying hard to shake the fear and reluctance I felt about wearing a wire. It was a tough call, balancing the risk of carrying a recorder against the unmistakable value of the hard evidence it could provide. Especially today, knowing that I'd be with a group of Mongols who were all convicted felons and who would all be in possession of firearms. Of course, Chacon and the U.S. Attorney's Office wanted me to get the evidence on tape. I sat in front of Chacon's house in a daze. "Billy boy, talk to me," he said. "Hey, bud, I need to gas up. I'll meet you at the gas station down the street. In the short distance between Chacon's place and the gas station, something hit me in the pit of my stomach. I don't know if it was cop intuition, plain fear, or a real guardian angel, but it came to me nonetheless, and without ambiguity. Don't carry a fucking tape recorder today, Billy. I knew Chacon and the U.S. Attorney's Office would be disappointed. Hell, I wanted to get the whole day's activities on tape myself. But I wanted to stay alive more. At the gas station, I got out of the car, bent down, and removed the tiny recording device from my boot. Chacon screeched to a stop in his Pontiac. I don't have a good feeling about the recorder, dude. I'm not going to carry it. I braced myself for the company line, but to my relief, Chacon looked at me and nodded. Go with your gut, he said. Tell you the truth, I don't have a good feeling about it either. The plan was to pick up Domingo at his house, and then he and I would ride up to Visalia in my car. We'd meet Red Dog and the rest of the boys when we got up there. I tossed the tape recorder to Chacon like it was a live hand grenade and sped off to Domingo's place. Chacon followed close behind me. I watched my speedometer passing 85, 90, then 100 miles per hour. I switched lanes repeatedly, but Johnny was keeping right up. Chacon and I had a thing about following each other on freeways. It wasn't exactly how you'd expect two on-duty feds to drive. It was more like a NASCAR race than an official ATF trip to an undercover operation. Again, I had to say a silent prayer for all the hapless civilians caught in the crossfire of our driving. But it was worth the potential risk of the speeding tickets. Running at 110 miles per hour, with Chacon on my tail, always helped to take my mind off things. As I pulled into Domingo's driveway, I looked in my rearview mirror to see if Chacon would pass by. But he didn't. I smiled to myself. He was finally learning how to play the surveillance game. I was feeling better about the day now. I didn't have the added mental baggage of the wire in my boot, and I followed the driveway into the backyard, which was protocol for Mongol doings at Domingo's place. Domingo came out of his house, happy to see me. Yo, Billy, what's happening, dude? I'm ready, Prez, let's do it. Then my good feeling took a quick and decisive dump. Out of nowhere, Domingo said, raise the hood on your car, Billy. As a Mongol prospect, I was well indoctrinated not to ask questions. A chill came over me. The car was hardwired for a recorder. Was there anything under the hood that would give me away? I was taking a mental inventory of the Mustang. What possible reason could Domingo have for wanting to check under my hood? He had to be looking for evidence of police recording equipment. Did something happen last night? Did they find something in their background checks? Was his whole day going to be a ruse to ambush and kill a federal agent? Where's your gun, Billy? Domingo asked. I thought for a moment before replying. Under the seat. Give it to me. I stopped dead. For the first time that day, I thought back to that Onion Field case in which both cops had complied with an order to surrender their handguns. Should I give up my piece to Domingo? Should I at least ask why? Should I take the bullets out first? Why the hell would he want my gun? I watched as Domingo, head under the hood, took the Mustang's air filter apart. With all the pride of a master criminal, he grinned up at me. Great hiding place, huh? Right. I pulled my snub-nosed blue steel .38 caliber revolver from under the car seat. I handed Domingo the gun. Bullets and all. Domingo took the air filter out and replaced it with our two guns. I'd never seen this trick, and I stood there wondering how many hidden guns I had missed during my 25 years in law enforcement. But then Domingo proceeded to throw the air filter into the trunk of the car, reinforcing my opinion that most criminals are inherently stupid. Let's go, dude. Domingo was no ball of fire. And being the only guy in the chapter besides me who didn't snort meth or coke, he lasted about 5 minutes on the road before he was sleeping like a newborn baby. He snored the entire 160-mile trip from the Rock to Visalia. I gave him a punch when we got there, and he directed me to a house just outside of town. I had no idea whose house it was, but I immediately recognized the character sitting out front. I could spot Red Dog's ugly mug a mile away. Lucifer was there along with an older, dark-skinned Mongol called CJ. I parked the car and got ready for the inevitable pile of shit Red Dog was going to shovel at me. I walked up to him to extend the traditional Mongol greeting. Red Dog held out his hand. As a Mongol prospect, I acknowledged with the official verbal response, "Order." Red Dog didn't say anything. "Order," I repeated. Red Dog again said nothing. At that point, I dropped my hand. Only now did Red Dog respond. He landed a sucker punch dead center to my solar plexus. I heard the thud and felt the air leave my chest as I doubled over, making sure I didn't give the impression that it hurt as much as it really did. Red Dog turned and walked away, laughing. I caught my breath. I told myself, "Payback is a bitch, brother." I began to do the prospect's slave chores, lighting smokes, fetching brews for the patches. I watched as lines of meth and coke were consumed along with an endless supply of beer. When Red Dog figured everyone was drunk and high enough, he gave an abrupt order. "Let's go shoot." He walked up to me, looked me in the eye, and said, "Follow me, prospect." Domingo and I got back in my Mustang and followed behind Red Dog, who was driving an old burgundy Chevy Monte Carlo. It was a trashy car and suited him well. I knew from Chacon that there were only two legal shooting ranges in the Visalia area. It would be a short ride to either one. 1 mile went by, then two, three, four, and five, until it was clear we weren't going to any licensed shooting range. I began to look in my rearview mirror to see if I could spot my backup. To my relief, I caught a split-second glimpse of Special Agent John Carr trailing our small convoy. We worked our way out of town, turning down one back road after another. Mile after mile of California countryside went by, my curiosity about where the hell we were going increasing with each one. Then we made an abrupt turn onto a dirt road. It wasn't really a road at all, more like a path. I didn't know where it would lead, but I did know my backup wouldn't be able to follow. My heart pounded. I was on my own with a bunch of armed, stoned criminals, and it was starting to look bad. The dirt path ran for maybe a quarter mile before opening up to an orange grove. At the far end of the grove was a small house next to an open field. The cars stopped, and all nine of us got out. I cut the motor on my car and was painfully cognizant of the fact that I might well be walking into my own death trap. What could I do? I got out along with everyone else. Domingo didn't say anything about getting our guns out from under the hood of the Mustang. I watched the scene unfolding around me with an almost surreal detachment. Red Dog was higher than a Georgia pine, clutching a loaded 9mm handgun. Crazy Craig, CJ, Domingo, Diablo, Bobby Loco, and Lucifer were all slapping magazines into their Glocks and Berettas. With the guns all loaded, the Mongols walked toward me, circling me. Red Dog held his Glock loosely at his side. "All right, Billy," he demanded. "How long was your fucking academy?" I was too stunned to open my mouth. Red Dog cocked his head to one side and moved even closer, hollering crazily, "I'm asking you a fucking question, Billy." "Huh? How long was your fucking academy, Billy?" He was yelling as if I was deaf, stupid, or both. "What are you talking about, Red Dog?" "You know what I'm talking about, Billy. Who the fuck did you tell you was coming up here? Who the fuck did you tell you was going to be with the Mongols today? Who, Billy?" "I didn't tell nobody. Come on, Red. Why are you acting like this? I didn't tell nobody I was coming up to Visalia." He locked his slate blue eyes on mine. "So you're saying if I put a bullet in the back of your fucking head right now, ain't nobody going to know where to start looking for you? Is that right, Billy?" "Yeah, I guess that's right, Red Dog." He gestured across the dusty, desolate, trash-strewn field and said, "All right, Billy, Go out there and set up some targets. I looked off in the distance for Chacon or Carr or any other backup, wondering if they would see or at least hear what I was sure was about to happen. If the shit went bad, I knew they'd come in and get me. In Vietnam, we had a pact. We all come out, or none of us come out. I felt the same loyalty from my ATF brothers, Carr, Kaz, and Chacon. Law enforcement, in many ways, was really just a civilian variation of the military, replete with honor and integrity and selfless sacrifices. If my sacrifice turned out to be my life, I knew my brother agents would come in and shoot it out with my killers. Small consolation. I glanced back toward the Mongols and saw them talking in a tight circle instead of pointing their guns and training their sights on me. Doing my best to collect myself, I set up a couple of beer cans, an empty milk jug, and some other trash left in the field by some previous gun-wielding outlaws.
"That's enough, Billy. Come on back," Red Dog yelled.
I wished he'd just tell me to keep walking down the dirt road. As I walked back toward them, I could hear the group laughing. I wasn't able to share in their levity. I knew that I was in for a long night. Before I reached the group, Red Dog raised his gun and capped off a round. I saw the flash and heard the deafening blast. I actually felt the wind from the bullet as it whizzed by me. Everybody laughed. Everybody but me. Then I heard someone give the order, "Fire at will." 8 drunk, cranked-up Mongols opened up for all they were worth, emptying one clip after another. The hit ratio in Vietnam was not all that admirable, but here, among the Mongols, it was downright pitiful. Maybe it was the alcohol and the meth, I don't know. But the end result was that I certainly didn't have to run out into the field to reset the targets. It was starting to get dark when Red Dog again turned his attention to me. He passed me his Glock, fully loaded. "Here, Billy, let's see what you can do." Behind me I heard Mongols murmuring. One of them said, "If he hits all the fucking targets, he's a cop." Another Mongol said, "If he misses all the fucking targets, he's a cop." With my special forces training and decades in law enforcement, I was an excellent shot. I'd put in hundreds of hours at the firing range and knew I could accurately hit all the targets in short order. I assumed an old-time military stance and cranked off a few rounds, hitting a few beer cans and intentionally missing a few others. After I'd emptied a magazine, I heard Lucifer say, "See, I told you he was a fucking cop." I couldn't help but laugh at him. "Yeah, why, Lucifer? Just because you guys can't hit shit?" Red Dog reclaimed his gun, reloaded it, and turned back toward the field. He raised the Glock, and I saw that his hand was riding too high on the grip. He fired, and the slide recoiled, slicing open his hand between his thumb and index finger. "Fuck!" He'd get no sympathy from me. Shouting and bleeding profusely, he dropped the gun. The shooting party was over. At least, that's what I thought. I was finally starting to relax. Maybe today wasn't my day to die after all. I told myself that since Red Dog was hurt, probably needed a few stitches in his hand, and it was getting dark, we'd be out of there in no time. Then reality bit me on the ass. Red Dog strutted up to me, wiping the blood from one hand with the other. He dropped down on one knee and began to wipe his bloody hands on my pants. I wasn't sure if this was some Mongol ritual. Then, to my shock, Red Dog grabbed one of the legs of my dirty jeans and jerked it up violently. With a small flashlight in hand, he began looking down into my boot, searching for a hidden recording device. I froze. Then he did the same with the other pant leg and boot. I alternated between mild panic and astonishment at Red Dog's actions. Finally, momentarily placated, Red Dog stood up. And in a voice loud enough for everyone to hear, he announced, "I'll find out if you're a cop." He turned and walked away. Day turned to night. We were still gathered behind the dilapidated house. From behind me, I could hear Mongol Eddie blurting out, "Shit, you ain't seen nothing yet." He ran off to the house and emerged with a street sweeper. He was grinning like a kid showing off his latest toy. We were all standing in a semicircle, and suddenly, like a maniac, Eddie fired off 12 rounds of 12-gauge buckshot into the ground, dead center in the circle of Mongols, inches from our feet. With an instinctive reaction, I covered my eyes and turned my head to keep from getting hit by flying debris.
What a fucking idiot!
I looked around to see if anyone had been hit. Somehow, despite Eddie's insane stunt, everybody came through unscathed.
Yo, dude, let me see that thing!
Bobby Loco shouted. Mongols passed the massive gun back and forth like a good joint. For the moment, at least, they weren't paying any attention to me. But soon the novelty of the street sweeper wore off. Out of the blue, Red Dog got up in my face with a new line of questioning.
Yo, Billy, where'd you go to high school?
In North Carolina, why?
'Cause I want to see your fucking yearbook.
Jesus, Red, that was 20-some years ago. I haven't seen my yearbook in I don't know how long.
You better see it pretty fucking soon.
And now, with darkness fully descended on the orange grove, Red Dog decided it was time to sic one of the most dangerous Mongols on me. CJ was a deep brown Indian, so dark-skinned that his many tattoos were barely visible on his arms. Within the biker underworld, CJ could function and gain a measure of acceptance, though he was clearly mentally challenged. I'd seen it before. When drinking hard and snorting meth, he would do whatever Red Dog told him to do, like some psychopathic robot. As Red Dog interrogated me about my school years, CJ suddenly approached, put his arm on my shoulder, partly for effect, partly for balance, then slurred his sour beer breath into my face.
Billy, I love you, brother, he said. But if you turn out to be a cop, I'll fucking kill you.
Everyone laughed loudly, and like a sponge, CJ soaked up his newfound attention. He was now clutching his knife in one hand, and he grabbed my neck in a hammerlock and glared at me with his coal black eyes.
If you hurt any of my brothers, Billy, I'll track you down. I'll put a piece of piano wire around your neck, and I'll cut your fucking head off. I don't care where you go. If you are a cop, I'm gonna find you.
Come on, CJ, lighten up. I'm not a cop. Not many things stuck with CJ, but the cop business did. The spotlight seemed to energize him. He was right in my face.
I don't care where you go, Billy. I'll track you down and I'll fucking kill you.
Red Dog chimed in.
Shit, Billy, he said. If I tell him to, CJ will kill you right now.
I felt CJ's grip tighten and tense up. His hand went to his knife again. I could sense him readying himself for the order to kill. I knew I had to make a move quickly, or this moron was going to act on his own and cut my throat. He was a dimwit, blind drunk, and just itching for some knife play.
Jesus, Red, tell him not to kill me now.
I tried to say it calmly, almost flippantly. Red Dog knew what everyone else knew. CJ was indeed about to act.
CJ, don't kill him right now, Red Dog said.
I watched CJ relax, take his hand off his knife. CJ would stay on me the rest of the night. He made sure I had a visual image of all the different ways that he was going to track me down and kill me. Hour after hour passed with him following me around, putting his arm around my shoulder, telling me how much he loved me, but how much he'd love to kill me if I turned out to be a cop. We still had a 3-hour trip back to L.A., and luckily, Domingo was ready to leave. As we got in my Mustang, Red Dog made his final demands.
Here's the deal, he said. I want to see your high school yearbook before you can patch in.
Like I give two shits about trying to patch in now. I'd nearly been executed by these gun-crazed maniacs, and had spent the last several hours listening to a deranged criminal psychopath telling me in excruciating detail all the different ways he was going to hunt me down and kill me. Fuck patching in and fuck this investigation. I don't even remember saying goodbye to anyone. I only remember getting in the car to leave with Domingo and the terrible feeling of being alone. Chapter 9. I vowed that I wouldn't be spending another night with Red Dog. I was so fed up with my prospect life, running around all over the place for the Mongols, following the commands of a group of criminals whose collective IQ didn't add up to the median temperature, and being in constant fear for my life, that I was ready to phone Chacon first thing in the morning and tell him the investigation was over. The ATF brass had wanted to shut the case down anyway, why not let them? The call was solely mine to make. No case agent can talk an undercover into continuing an investigation if he feels it's become too dangerous. But after my head cleared and my fury at Red Dog's abuse had subsided, I felt I had a better handle on the night's events. It was probably just another of Red Dog's mind games, another sadistic attempt to fuck with my sanity. If he'd truly known something, or had some solid reason to believe I was a cop, he would have had CJ kill me right there with no witnesses besides those Mongols. The week following Visalia, I was staring at myself in the full-length living room mirror. Hang in there, Billy. You can't be too far from becoming a full patch. But hang in there for what? So Red Dog could finally dig up some dirt on me? So the Mongols could leave me in a deserted ditch somewhere with a bullet in my head? My ATF bosses had made it abundantly clear that they didn't give a shit about either Billy St. John or Bill Queen. I could so easily go back to my desk job in the Van Nuys office, making routine one-man, one-gun cases until my retirement day. But I prided myself on being more than a typical agent. I prided myself on following in the footsteps of ATF men who put their lives on the line doing undercover work, men like Steve Martin, Darren Kozlowski, Daryl Edwards, and Blake Boteler. The list was long and distinguished, and it kept rolling through my head, along with images of John Chacon having to eat a teaspoon of administrative shit every day in the L.A. office, and then hanging out on the streets watching my back until all hours of the morning. Images of my brother coming back from Vietnam on a stretcher. Images of some 58,000 soldiers who didn't come back at all. I saw my work as part of a tradition of service to this country, and as I fastened my black bandana around my neck, that sense of tradition began to overwhelm the thought of Red Dog or CJ shooting me. Yes, I'd hang in there, and I'd beat Red Dog and the rest of the Mongols. As I sat in the passenger seat of Chacon's Pontiac after Visalia, John came at me straight out. "You think you can go forward, Billy? You think you can go back in there?" "Yeah, I do. If I can steer clear of Red Dog, I think I can patch in. We put too much time into the case, and I think I may be a month or two away from that top rocker. By this point, I have been riding with the Mongols for about 6 months." Chacon and I were both surprised that we had gotten this far, given the gang's erratic behavior and propensity for hair-trigger violence. We had been able to skirt all the case-ending events that had arisen during the investigation. Some, thanks to correct decisions on our part, and some, like the target practice in the Orange Grove, thanks to pure luck. On a hot Thursday night in August, Rocky, Domingo, and I planned to do the bar scene in the valley. Rocky and Domingo were bringing their wives, and I was a fifth wheel, tagging along to do security for the chapter president. We weren't riding our bikes, and we weren't wearing any patches. Domingo, despite his tough guy persona, was quite the lively entertainer. He had a good baritone voice and enjoyed singing at several karaoke bars in the valley. Many bar owners were justifiably nervous about Mongols being in their establishments, but I suppose some enjoyed the mystique of having outlaws as patrons. Despite being chronically unemployed, Rocky's wife Vicky had managed to buy a new car on credit, and Rocky wanted to show it off. I had called Chacon and told him that it was going to be an uneventful night of karaoke singing. Just me, Domingo, and Rocky with their old ladies hitting a few bars in the valley. No bikes, no patches. So none of the other backup guys needed? No backup. Tell the boys to take the night off. Chacon would be following me on solo surveillance duty in his Pontiac. The plan was for me to park my bike over at Domingo's, and we would all drive in Vicky's new car. I left the UC apartment at 6 p.m., I rolled into Domingo's place and parked my bike in the back. Domingo's wife, Terry, met me at the door, sporting a fresh black eye.
Come on in, Billy. Domingo's taking a shower. You want a beer?
You bet. As usual, I helped myself. They had nothing but beer in the fridge anyway. I had never seen Domingo beat Terry before, and it was a bit of a surprise to see her with a black eye. Like a lot of biker women, Terry was an embodiment of the battered woman syndrome. And on some level, I suppose, she had confused that kind of negative attention from Domingo with genuine love. Maybe she'd never known any other kind in her life. It sickened me to see any woman get beaten up by a man, but I was in no position to moralize on the subject. I was living the life of an outlaw, and in their world there were very few old ladies who I didn't see regularly sporting the signs of domestic abuse. Domingo now bounded from the bathroom, a towel wrapped around him. Still dripping, he walked up to me and did the Mongol handshake. I hugged him tight, and the water from his chest soaked through my shirt. It was the first time I had seen Domingo without all his biker gear on. Not only were his arms tatted up, but his legs sported a couple of barrio tattoos as well. Rocky and Vicky arrived with their newly financed car. Domingo finished getting dressed and told Terry to hurry up. Then we all headed out for our night on the town. As he got in the car, Rocky pulled a revolver from his waist and tucked it under the front seat. I had never seen this gun before. It was a blue steel revolver that looked, from the quick glimpse I caught, to be a .38 caliber. I made note of that detail for the ROI I'd be typing up in my UC apartment sometime before sunrise. We hit a couple of karaoke bars in the valley until 10 p.m., when Domingo, bored with belting out Santana tunes, changed the plan. Let's head back over the hill and hit the Sundowner. The Sundowner was a semi-regular hangout for us. The parking lot was dark, except for one small area lit up enough for a security camera to keep a keen eye on the motorcycles. Loud music was blaring from the back door. Several bikes were parked out back, including two adorned with black and white stickers. For me, this meant that I'd be prospecting and fetching beers for at least two more full-patch Mongols. My relaxed mood faded as we walked through the back door. It was dark in the narrow hallway, and the bar was standing room only. I assessed the potential for trouble. A battle-scarred barroom brawler leaned against an ice machine to the left. He had a Budweiser in hand, and judging from his stare, he was probably into his second or third six-pack of the evening. He was looking too hard in the direction of Domingo's wife. He started to say something to her, but I couldn't hear it clearly over the blasting jukebox. Domingo picked up on the comment, though. Rocky pushed forward through the crowd. I stood shoulder to shoulder with my president. The drunk had stopped staring at Terry. His angry glare was now fixed on Domingo. Domingo squared off in front of him.
What the fuck you looking at?
He shouted in the drunk's face.
You!
The drunk spat back defiantly. Domingo's fist landed dead center on the drunk's chin. His beer flew straight up from his hand and hit the ceiling as he fell backward onto the ice machine. The bouncer was standing close by and grabbed Domingo in a bear hug.
Easy, big boy, he said.
With Domingo's arms pinned, the drunk made a remarkable recovery and drew back to unload on Domingo. Neither the bouncer nor Domingo saw the punch coming, but I knew what I had to do. Before the drunk could land his punch, I caught him with a hard right hand to the head and knocked him to the floor. Before I could throw another fist, though, images from the United States Attorney's Office began to flash through my mind. This exact scenario had been run past me. Sitting in the offices of Assistant United States Attorneys Sally Mellock and Jerry Friedberg, two of the most respected prosecutors in the district, I had asked, "What do I do when confronted with a violent situation like a barroom fight?" Jerry's response was to stick his fingers in his ears and begin chanting, la, 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 la. I said, look, I don't have to let someone hurt me, do I? Of course not, Jerry answered. Mellock and Friedberg both knew that the Mongols would expect nothing less from me than they would from any other Mongol prospect. I had to use my best judgment, but as far as the U.S. Attorney's Office was concerned, I could vigorously defend myself or my fellow Mongols, as long as I didn't instigate any fights. The drunk was now on his hands and knees. I grabbed him from behind, and wanting to put on a good display without really hurting him, I began a series of blows to the back of his head with only a semi-closed fist. In truth, it was hurting my hand more than it was his head. But I had to look like I was beating this guy's ass in order to save his life. I needed to get him out of the club before we saw any knives or Rocky's snub-nosed 38. As I punched his head, I began pulling him toward the back door. But now, Easy, one of the other Mongol patches in the Sundowner, came flying over to help out. Easy was a lunatic, ready to kill for the club at any moment. I'd only pulled the drunk a couple of steps toward the door when Easy caught him square in the face with his steel-toed boot. The kick was so high and vicious, it looked like Easy was trying to kick a 50-yard field goal. Boom! The blood went splattering as the drunk's head recoiled toward me. I cringed at the sight. I knew I had to get him out of the bar before he was stomped to death right before my eyes. Easy landed another steel toe to his face. I began to drag him faster toward the door. Another savage kick landed, and another. I pulled him into the narrow hallway where there was not enough room for Easy to kick him anymore. I landed a couple more show punches to the back of his head, yanking him harder toward the back door. Finally, he was outside, but Easy was out in the parking lot with us and landed another devastating boot to the drunk's face. He collapsed on the ground. I let go of the back of his shirt. Then, like a stunned deer on the highway, the drunk rolled over once, sprang to his feet, and sprinted out of the parking lot. By this time, more than half the Sundowner had emptied into the parking lot. The owner and the manager were attempting to calm everybody down and restore some order. Domingo and I joined the line walking back inside. We had made it to the hallway when round two began. Another inebriated patron, even bigger than the last one, was walking our way. He caught Domingo with an intentional elbow, knocking him into the wall. My adrenaline was still pumping from the first fight, and I reacted on instinct, grabbing his shirt, forcing him against the wall. The guy's fist seemingly came from nowhere, catching me upside the head. I reeled back. Although stunned, I didn't let go of his shirt, and I responded with a fast shot to his face. I saw his hand go to his back belt area, then a very shiny Bowie knife coming up fast. I let go of his shirt and sprang backward toward the other side of the hall. He swiped the knife across the front of my jacket, slicing it clean open across the front. I jumped back again as he lunged forward repeatedly, trying to stab me, until I was outside in the parking lot. He kept coming at me. He wasn't trying to slash me now. He was trying to run me through with that 8-inch blade. Suddenly, I saw Rocky out of the corner of my eye. I hoped that he'd been to the car to retrieve that .38 caliber revolver. Shoot him! Shoot him, Rocky! Just like that, I knew that this investigation was over. I was in pure survival mode. Rocky would kill him. I could see myself on the witness stand, testifying that I'd begged my chapter's sergeant-at-arms to shoot this crazed, knife-wielding attacker. He swiped the knife at me again, nearly splitting open my face. Shoot him, Rocky! For fuck's sake! Shoot him! But as it turned out, Rocky knew this drunk. I heard Rocky hollering his name. Before he could take another swipe at me, he looked at Rocky and lowered the knife. Everything stopped except the pounding in my heart. Rocky ran up to him, screaming, "What the fuck's the matter with you, you fucking idiot?" Easy had made his way back out with another patched Mongol and moved toward the blade-wielding drunk. He was now holding the Bowie knife down by his side. I stood there shaking with rage. The Mongols demanded the knife. I figured once they had the guy's knife, we'd square off in a fist fight and I'd clean his fucking clock. My heart was racing a mile a minute. Not in this life, cop or no cop, had I ever let anyone attack me like this without serious retaliation. I shook with rage as I waited for the Mongols to get his knife. Then he handed the knife over to Rocky. I moved forward to finish this guy off, but my path was blocked by Easy. "Hold on, Billy. We're gonna take care of this." I bit my lip, waiting to see what was going to happen. To my disbelief, the Mongols let the drunk off the hook.
What the fuck? I said.
Domingo, Rocky, and Easy huddled for a minute, talking to the guy. Then I watched my attacker walk away. Domingo turned and explained the situation to me.
Don't worry about this shit, Billy. We got his knife. I told him that he would have to come up to the place next Tuesday to get it back. When he shows up, you're gonna stab him with it.
My heart stopped pounding.
Hell yeah, be my pleasure.
He'd insulted the club. No one ever did that to a Mongol. No one ever attempted to hit a Mongol, stab a Mongol, or insult a Mongol without bringing down the most violent form of retribution. Domingo knew that too many eyewitnesses had seen our faces in the sundowner, and that if we killed the guy here, we'd all be getting locked up for it. But next week, at the place, would be a different story. I looked at the Bowie knife in Domingo's hand and pictured myself cutting the guy open in a dark alley behind the place. But sanity quickly returned, although I really wanted to throw a few fists at the guy. There was no way I was going to stab him. I'd been a cop for 25 years, and it wasn't likely that ATF or the U.S. Attorney's Office would authorize me gutting a guy with his own 8-inch Bowie knife, no matter how much he deserved it. We were all watching for the cops to show up at any moment. Domingo gave the order to split, and we loaded up in Rocky's car. Now, I had another problem. How was I going to get out of stabbing the guy? There needed to be some kind of answer to the question, or this case was over. The next church was held on Saturday at Buckethead's place. Everything had gone back to normal since Thursday night's melee at the Sundowner. As I stood outside Buckethead's house, doing my prospect duty, I heard a loud voice calling from inside.
Prospect Billy, get in here!
I hustled in to a group of Mongols sitting around the kitchen table.
Listen, Prospect, Rocky said. We just got one question for you.
Yeah, Rock?
What the hell was with all those haymakers you were throwing the other night? Dude, you gotta stay tucked in. Make shorter punches when you're on top of a motherfucker like that.
I laughed. Yeah, I'll try to do better the next time around. They all laughed along with me.
Okay, Domingo said. Get out of here.
I was halfway out the door when Domingo called me back in. Oh, by the way, that fuckhead that tried to stab you the other night, he found out that you were a Mongol and took off for fucking Florida. I guess you're not gonna get to stab him, Prospect.
Shit.
Yeah, too bad, huh? Back in February 1998, when Chacon called me up to ask if I wanted a shot at riding UC with the Mongols, neither he nor I thought that I'd be able to actually patch into the gang. Rumors flew about the secretive initiation rites of various clubs. In some cases, a prospective member had to commit a serious felony. Often, he had to commit murder for the club. The outlaws had long ago figured out the lines that a law enforcement officer, no matter how deep undercover, could not legally cross. Initiations could be brutal, degrading, and downright filthy. You might be required to take hard drugs and participate in sexual acts with women. Back in the 1960s, prospects were beaten and covered in human feces before gaining that coveted top rocker. The fact is, neither Chacon nor I knew what I might have to do while riding with the Mongols. I had my own line in the sand, but I was worried I'd find myself in a situation when I'd unexpectedly have to leap across it. But I had now become the best prospect the Mongols' MC had ever seen. I'd hauled drugs for them, stood guard for them, and now I'd shed my blood fighting for the club. What more could they want from me? It was mid-October, somewhere around 6 in the evening, when I left my place and headed for the Rock. I had talked with Chacon earlier, and he was planning to tail me in his Pontiac for what we assumed would be another routine night of prospecting. We had gathered enough information and evidence by this time that criminal cases were starting to come together, and the U.S. Attorney's Office was thrilled with our progress. Besides that, on the personal level, Red Dog was on my list. If it was the last thing I ever did in my life, I was determined to see that Red Dog was going to prison. I'd taken more shit off him than from anyone else in my law enforcement career, and he was going to pay for it. Red Dog's wind-burned face became a kind of beacon to me, driving me forward to get to the finish line. As I rode through Tujunga, I could see his image in my mind, his snarling, taunting face inches from my own.
Billy, did your president tell you that you ain't ever gonna get your Mongo patch?
He'd said one afternoon when we were all down in Venice Beach. No, Red, nobody ever told me that.
Well, you ain't. And you want to know why, Billy?
Yeah, Red Dog, I want to know why. He smiled his nasty, yellow-toothed smile.
'Cause you ain't Chacon, Billy. This is a Chicano club, and Billy, you ain't Chacon.
Everybody laughed at me. I stared at Red Dog.
Check me if I'm wrong, Red, but you ain't Chacon either.
Everybody laughed again, except Red Dog. Now, as I rode, I thought about the orange grove and Red Dog holding his Glock. I rolled on until I found myself turning onto Foothill Boulevard. I always held my breath to see what bikes were sitting out front, or who might be standing next to them. As the place came into sight, I could see three or four bikes. I rolled up in front and backed my straight pipes to the curb.
"You need to be on your toes tonight, Billy," Domingo said when I walked inside. "The national president's going to be here."
With Little Dave, the top dog from the mother chapter, coming to the place, I'd be running my ass off all night. A couple more bikes rolled up out front. I glanced out to see who it was. Two Mongol patches backed to the curb. I saw Stinky, one of the regular biker chicks, and a couple of others like her milling about. I heard that familiar spine-tingling call,
"Prospect!"
and turned to see Rancid offering me a hit off his JD bottle. I grabbed it and downed a gulp. Rancid looked at me with a strange expression.
"I like you, Billy," he said.
Rancid hardly ever called me anything but Prospect. His using my first name made me a little uneasy. I was always studying these guys for the most subtle changes in their demeanor, any little tick that would indicate some change in their attitude toward me. The national president, Little Dave, rolled up. Now the whole SFV chapter was at the place, along with a few Mongols from other chapters. It was truly going to be a long work night for Prospect Billy. Evil walked up to me and said,
"Take your colors off a minute, Billy. I want to see the inside of them."
The request was a bit strange, but I knew better than to challenge a patch. I slipped my colors off, turned them inside out, then held them up for Evil to see. Before I could react, he snatched my colors from my hand, then started yelling at me like a maniac.
"I got your colors, Prospect! What the fuck's up with that?"
I didn't know how to react. Evil threw my colors back in my face.
"You never let anyone take your colors, Prospect! Never!"
He turned and walked out. Domingo stormed across the bar to me. He looked pissed.
"Billy, did Evil get your colors?"
I was taken aback. "Yeah. But he set me up, Domingo. He told me to take them off. Then he snatched them from me." Domingo stared, angry and thick-necked as a pit bull.
"Billy, don't ever let anyone get your colors, you son of a bitch!"
He turned and walked out. Everything was going straight to hell. Here I thought Evil liked me. There was no reason for him to make me look bad, especially in front of the national president. Rocky came in now and gave me the same treatment as Domingo.
"Billy, did you let Evil get your colors?"
he asked.
"Yeah, Rock, but I mean, he set me up."
Rocky looked very disappointed in me.
"Look, man, Domingo wants to see you out back."
Out back? I didn't dare ask what was going on. Several other patrons had overheard and seen what had happened with me and Evil. Despite the happy clinking of beer bottles and the hard rock blasting from the jukebox, the atmosphere in the bar was now tense, as if something terrible was about to go down. I turned and walked out. Rocky walked close behind me as if he was escorting me. All the Mongols had now assembled behind the place. It was dark outside, and everyone was quiet as I walked up. Little Dave, the national president, looked at me and said sharply,
"Get in the circle and face your president, Prospect."
What the hell had I stepped into? My supposed offense, letting Evil snatch my colors, didn't seem egregious enough for all this drama. I couldn't make sense of it. Still,
I had my colors on now, and they damn sure weren't going to shoot me with my colors on. Domingo leaned in and gave me another direct command. Take your colors off, Prospect.
What kind of setup was this? Did I dare take my colors off again and have Domingo or one of the other patches snatch it from me?
Slowly, I took my colors off, but clenched them tightly in my hand. Domingo got right in my face now, but he didn't make a grab for my colors.
You'll never let anybody get your colors, Billy. Never. Why was Evil able to get your colors, Billy? Why?
He set me up, Domingo. He said he wanted to see the inside of them, so I took them off for him.
He set me up. Evil had jumped up and was hollering in my face.
You better watch what you say, Prospect.
Come on, Evil, I said. What's this all about?
This is all about you letting somebody snatch your colors, Domingo snarled.
I thought that maybe I had embarrassed Domingo in front of the national president. Maybe it was all about some perceived act of disrespect, and they were getting ready to sentence me to an ass-whipping back here. But then Domingo's face softened a bit.
Well, anyway, ain't nobody in the SFV chapter ever got their full patch without fucking up along the way. I guess tonight was your fuck-up, Billy. You want to lose that center patch, Billy?
Okay. Losing my center patch was better than getting shot. But then I thought about prospecting for another month or two, running my ass ragged trying to keep a bunch of crank and beer-fueled Mongols happy and fully satisfied.
Hell no! I worked my fucking ass off for this! No, don't feel bad, Billy, Domingo said. Everybody seems to lose their center before they get their top.
No way, Domingo. Come on, I was set up.
You want to keep that center patch, Billy?
Shit, yeah, I want to keep it. Suddenly, Domingo reached under his colors as if drawing a gun.
If you want to keep that center, he said, then sew this on.
He pulled out a Mongol top rocker and threw it to me. A massive cheer swept through from the crowd of Mongols. Beer cans were raised, shaken, sprayed open, and dumped on my head. I was screaming along with the rest of the Mongols, "Yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah!" I grabbed the Mongol top rocker and waved it like a precious flag. A genuine sense of pride welled up inside of me. I was being pulled back and forth, hugged and backslapped, as the beer ran down me, drenching my hair and clothes, streaming in my eyes until I was blind. I wanted that patch for real. Jesus! I had made it. I wanted Chacon there. I wanted Kaz, Carr, Pratt, and Hardin, all my ATF brethren, there to see that I'd made it. I was a fully patched-in member of the most violent outlaw motorcycle gang in America. Shit! I was grinning and howling as I reached up to wipe the beer away, except that now the liquid I was half-drowning in didn't feel like beer at all. It was thick as molasses and sticking in my hair and beard. Squinting through the foam and syrupy mess, I saw one Mongol holding a can over my head. They were baptizing me in a mix of Budweiser and 50-weight motor oil. Everybody was laughing and whooping it up. Domingo handed me a full-patch T-shirt, black and white, with the fierce-looking Mongol logo.
Here you go, Billy. I've been saving this for you.
I wiped my eyes so I could see more clearly. I'd actually made it. I'd done what I never thought we would really be able to do. I was a Mongol. I was an ATF agent. Well, what the hell was I? We all walked back to the front of the place. Karina met me, giving me a hug and congratulations. She handed me a towel, laughing at me as I went to work trying to wipe my face.
It's gonna take a while to clean you up, she said.
I reached into my jeans and pulled out a wad of cash, bought rounds for the whole house, high-fiving, back-slapping, doing the Mongol handshake everywhere I walked. Stinky was putting on a show just for me, pulling up her dress every few minutes to show off the fact that she wasn't wearing a bra or panties. I let out a wild cheer. I wasn't a lowly hang-around or prospect anymore. I was a full-patch Mongol, a one-percenter, an outlaw biker. No one could touch me now. I put on my full-patch T-shirt and walked outside, hoping Chacon would see me in it through his binoculars from his parked Pontiac. I knew he'd be beside himself with pride. No more prospecting. Tonight, I'd fire up my hog and ride home a full-fledged outlaw. At about 2 in the morning,
It was time to close the bar and go home. The national president happened to live south of L.A., not far from me, and he and I would be rolling out together. Stinky had started home a couple of minutes before Little Dave and I fired up our bikes. She had walked up the street to the point where she was right beside Chacon's car when she heard Little Dave and me racing up the hill. Then she turned, bent down, and grabbed the bottom of her dress, pulling it up over her shoulders to expose her completely nude body to Little Dave, me, and the most appreciative backup ATF agent in the country. Little Dave and I rode to the split in the 2 and 134 freeways, where I broke off and headed east. I was doing 90 miles per hour and feeling sky high. Red Dog didn't matter now. Nothing else mattered. I'd fucking done it. I was a Mongol. Chapter 10. Becoming a full patch was like breaking out of a dark corridor into a field of sunlight. So many things were possible now. I would still have to answer to Domingo, my chapter president, and to all the national officers, but my peer status in the gang opened investigative directions and opportunities we'd never thought possible. For months, Rocky had been telling me about a machine gun that he had at his place. I really wanted to buy that gun from him. Since he was the chapter's sergeant-at-arms, Rocky had a lot of guns at his disposal, some his own, some the property of the chapter. I'd seen him with a variety of semi-automatics and revolvers, as well as a sawed-off shotgun, an assault rifle, and a machine gun. While I was a prospect and under such heavy scrutiny, I wouldn't have dared offer to buy those guns. Even a dim bulb like Rocky would have seen that as a red flag. But now that I was a patched member of the club, I felt I could pull it off. Rocky had been out of work for a while, and most of the money he made selling drugs went to fueling his and his wife Vicky's drug habit. He and I were riding in my wired Mustang when he brought up the subject of selling off a few of his guns. I told Rocky that I wanted the sawed-off shotgun for myself and that I had a friend named Bob who would probably buy everything else. Bob was actually a confidential informant for ATF. As with a lot of CIs, there were times when I think he wasn't sure whose side he wanted to be on. But he had made a couple of other good cases for ATF, and I felt he could help me out. We had the cash from ATF. I was going to meet Rocky, go by his dad's house, pick up the guns, and meet Bob and another CI named Sergio in the parking lot of Coco's restaurant. At 6 that evening, I rolled by Rocky's place. His kids were playing out front in the fenced yard, which also contained one of the biggest pit bulls I had ever seen. It had taken me months to make friends with that dog, just to feel comfortable entering Rocky's yard. But I never did feel comfortable about seeing little Rocky, who was only 3 years old, playing alone with the dog. As a father of two young boys, I found that scary as hell. I could picture the pit locking those powerful jaws onto the little kid's neck. I walked past the dog, the kids, a busted-up motorcycle, and all the assorted junk. Vicky answered my knock, telling me to come in. Rocky was getting ready. I was carrying a digital wire that evening to get the deal on tape. The wire was concealed in my leather jacket, and I knew better than to take it off. I had carried a miniature tape recorder in my jacket to Rocky's place once before. I'd taken the jacket off, laid it on the couch, and gone into Rocky's bedroom for a few minutes. Sloppy mistake on my part. Vicky, dope fiend that she was, picked up my jacket and started rifling through my pockets looking for money. I came out from the bedroom and caught her in the act. She just shrugged at me sheepishly, and it was blind luck that she didn't find my hidden recorder. That damn sure wasn't going to happen again. My leather jacket might as well have been riveted to my back. I sat talking with Vicky while she flicked her lighter, sucking hard on her bong. Rocky walked out of the bedroom. "Hey, brother," he said, grabbing me with the traditional Mongol handshake and hug. There was such genuine affection in Rocky's embrace, making this another one of those disorienting moments for me. There was no doubt in my mind that Rocky really loved Billy St. John. Vicky was ignoring the kids, still sucking furiously on her bubbling bong as Rocky and I left the house. We climbed in my Mustang and headed for Rocky's dad's place, only a mile up the road.
Rocky was telling me a story about Silent, a Mongol who was featured on America's Most Wanted for a vicious murder. I had seen Silent one time, drinking in the place. True to his name, he sat by himself and didn't utter a word the whole night. This was the essence of my split-screen life. I was pretending to be interested in Rocky's stories about Silent, while all the time I was documenting every detail of our drive for what I knew would ultimately be Rocky's criminal prosecution for this deal. Rocky's dad's place was a typical low-income Tohunga house. It was locked up and nobody was home.
End of Disc 4.